From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
For Indonesian government, until now, they still put politics over the people.
Today, we continue to look at the area hardest hit by the tsunami, Aceh. Over 100,000 dead in Indonesia alone. We'll speak with an Achenese refugee whose mother was a women's rights activist in Aceh, imprisoned by the Indonesian government. The prison was destroyed by the tsunami.
Mother was put in jail for 11 years after the tsunami. We cannot find her body.
But first, ExxonMobil has contributed $5 million to the relief efforts. They operate one of the largest gas fields in the world in Aceh. They're being sued for gross human rights violations. We'll speak with a lawyer who's just returned from Indonesia, where he was interviewing plaintiffs against ExxonMobil in Aceh. And as the 109th Congress convenes today, Republican lawmakers make a surprise move in the ethics scandal surrounding Majority Leader Tom DeLay. We'll also remember Shirley Chisholm with Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton. All that and more are coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations has increased the latest death toll in Asia's tsunami disaster to more than 150,000, warning it could still soar as relief workers are confronted by huge, devastated areas without roads, bridges, and airstrips. Helicopters and elephants became the most useful tools for relief teams trying to reach remote areas to find and feed survivors and shift the rubble of razed towns. Aid workers struggled to help thousands huddled in makeshift camps on Indonesia's northern Sumatra island, where the tsunami claimed two-thirds of its victims. And the UN says it is concentrating efforts on the area due to the threat of disease. In Sri Lanka, the second worst-hit nation, with more than 30,000 dead and 850,000 homeless, there's little sign of an organized government relief effort, but food distribution looks to be smoother. Meanwhile, a women's collective in Sri Lanka said rapists are preying on survivors at refugee centers. The UN International Children's Emergency Fund, UNICEF, estimates about 50,000 children have died across South Asia, a third of the overall toll. Tens of thousands more have been orphaned. In other developments, President Bush named his father and former President Bill Clinton as the joint coordinators of a campaign to encourage Americans to donate to existing charities. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State General Colin Powell and Florida Governor Jeb Bush arrived in Phuket, Thailand on Tuesday to begin their tour of the tsunami-hit region. After meeting the Thai Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister upon their arrival in Bangkok, Powell and Bush flew to Phuket, where they held a joint news conference. This is Colin Powell.
We also made a significant contribution with our military forces who are now operating in the area. One aircraft carrier battle group is here. An amphibious group will be here shortly. American helicopters are ferrying relief supplies to communities in need, and we're also providing significant quantities of food and water and other supplies.
Colin Powell speaking in Thailand. We'll have more on the tsunami in a few minutes. Baghdad Governor Ali al-Haidari has been shot dead in a roadside ambush in the Iraqi capital, the highest-profile assassination there since May. Attackers shot at his armored, plated car from different directions as his convoy drove through northern Baghdad. It was the highest-profile political assassination in 8 months. Al-Haidari had survived a previous assassination attempt on his life in September. He died today just moments before a suicide bomber killed 10 people and wounded 58 others in a separate attack on a checkpoint close to Baghdad's fortified Green Zone. Analysts say the attack demonstrates the power of opponents of the U.S.-backed regime to strike at the heart of Iraq's governing class ahead of the planned January 30th election. Yesterday, two Britons were killed in a suicide bomb attack in Baghdad while an explosives-laden car attempted to ram through a checkpoint on a road leading to party offices of the unelected interim prime minister, Yadalawi. The bomber hit a police pickup truck, and two officers and a civilian were killed in the explosion. Meanwhile, Iraq's National Intelligence Chief said Monday the number of resistance fighters in Iraq has grown to more than 200,000 active fighters and sympathizers. General Mohammed Abdullah Shawani told Agence France-Presse, quote, "I think the resistance is bigger than the U.S. military in Iraq. I think the resistance is more than 200,000 people." He said the number includes at least 40,000 hardcore fighters, but rises to more than 200,000 members, counting part-time fighters and volunteers who provide rebels everything from intelligence to logistics to shelter. The numbers far exceed any figure presented by the U.S. military in Iraq. A senior U.S. military officer declined to endorse or dismiss the spy chief's numbers, telling Agence France-Presse, quote, "As for the size of the insurgency, we don't have good resolution on the size." The U.S.-backed spy chief also questioned the success of the November campaign to retake Fallujah, which U.S. forces have hailed as a major victory against the resistance. Asked if the insurgents were winning, he answered, quote, "I would say they aren't losing." 8 Palestinians were killed Tuesday, 7 more injured after Israeli army tanks fired shells at the town of Beit Lahia in northern Gaza Strip. Witnesses said that at around 7 a.m. local time, as students were on their way to school and farmers headed to their fields, an Israeli tank shell hit the main street of the small town. The tank attack reportedly came after militants fired homemade rockets at the northern Jewish settlement of Nisanet. Palestinian medics at Kamal Adwan Hospital in northern Gaza said the bodies of 8 Palestinians had been brought to the hospital, including 4 children under the age of 17 and 4 farmers. 4 of the dead were from a single family. The field where farmers had been harvesting strawberries was splattered with blood and body parts. Shortly after the attack, Palestinian presidential candidate Mahmoud Abbas called Israel, quote, "the Zionist enemy" for the first time, saying, quote, "We are praying for the souls of our martyrs who fell today to the shells of the Zionist enemy." In recent days, Palestinian officials have charged that recent Israeli army incursions threatened to disrupt the election for a successor to Yasser Arafat. On a campaign stop yesterday in Rafah, Mahmoud Abbas's main opponent, Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, spoke to reporters on the campaign trail.
Israel wants to destroy the democratic process and wants to destroy not only Palestinian life, but even the democratic free process. But regardless of what they did, they beat me, they arrested me, they stopped me at checkpoints, but nothing will stop us.
The leader of an armed nationalist group that seized a remote police station in Peru has reportedly surrendered after a hostage crisis that began on Saturday when the group took 10 officers hostage and allegedly killed 4 others. A Peruvian government spokesperson told the Associated Press that former Army Major Antauro Humala was in custody after turning himself in to Peru's national police chief at the town's municipal building. She said about 90 of his followers also laid down their arms. The group wants to establish a nationalist indigenous movement modeled on the ancient Incan Empire and has demanded the resignation of President Alejandro Toledo. Humala enjoys strong local support. Thousands of residents converged on the town square Monday demanding a peaceful settlement. At one point, Humala joined them during what he claimed was a 3-hour truce agreed to by police. Toledo, who took office in July 2001 with a popularity rating of nearly 60%, has tried to distance himself from a series of corruption scandals during the past year. His approval rating has sunk to 9%. Here in this country, stung by criticism that they're lowering ethical standards, Republican lawmakers last night reversed a rule change that would have allowed House Majority Leader Tom DeLay to retain his position even if indicted. The Republicans met behind closed doors of the House chamber and reportedly acted at the request of Tom DeLay himself. The surprise move by the Republicans came just hours before the 109th Congress convenes today. New members of the House and Senate will be sworn in, including Barack Obama of Illinois. He'll become the first African-American man to enter the Senate in a quarter of a century as a senator. He'll be the only African-American senator. We'll have more on Tom DeLay and the new Congress later in the program. Finally, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Mohamed El-Baradei, will run unchallenged for a third term as head of the UN Nuclear Watch Group, a move that puts a serious dent in the U.S. campaign to oust him. The Vienna-based International Atomic Energy Agency said this week no other candidates had come forward before the December 31st deadline. El-Baradei, who is an Egyptian lawyer and diplomat, has headed the agency since 1997. He's been critical of the U.S. occupation of Iraq and Washington's position on Iran. The U.S. efforts to oust him were damaged last month when the Washington Post reported that the U.S. had tapped his phones. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, as the United Nations puts the confirmed death toll from the Asian tsunami at more than 150,000, we'll continue our special coverage of the devastation of the hardest hit area, that is the Aceh region of Indonesia, where the death toll is expected to rise over 100,000. In a few moments, we'll be joined by two Achenese refugees in this country who have been involved in talking about what has been taking place in Aceh over the last years. But first, we turn to a story that's gotten almost no attention, and that's the story of the oil giant ExxonMobil, a corporation that has a massive investment in Aceh. According to some estimates, ExxonMobil has extracted some $40 billion from its operation in Aceh, Indonesia. According to human rights groups, ExxonMobil has hired military units of the Indonesian National Army to provide, quote, security for their gas extraction and liquefaction project in the region. Members of these military units, they say, regularly have perpetrated ongoing and severe human rights abuses against local villagers, including murder, rape, torture, destruction of property. Human rights groups further charge that ExxonMobil has continued to finance the military and to produce company to provide company equipment and facilities that have been used by the Indonesian military to commit atrocities. For years, the Washington, D.C.-based International Labor Rights Fund has fought a series of legal battles to hold ExxonMobil responsible for its record in Aceh. We're joined now by two guests in Washington. We're joined by Bama Athreya, who is the deputy director of the International Labor Rights Fund, as well as Derek Baxter, who is a lawyer with that group. He's just returned from Indonesia, where he was speaking with people who are involved in the lawsuit. We want to welcome you both to Democracy Now! And begin with Derek Baxter. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us, Derek. I wanted to start off by saying that we did invite ExxonMobil on the program. They said at first they would participate in the program if we were just talking about their contribution, ExxonMobil's contribution to the relief efforts. They're one of the largest corporate contributors to the relief efforts. They've pledged more than $5 million. They did write us an email. They said, quote, surprised your program would choose to divert attention from the unprecedented outpouring of support and coordination among multinational and local relief agencies in Indonesia by pursuing an ambush interview with one of the largest corporate contributors to those efforts. Derek Baxter, can you respond?
Well, we welcome ExxonMobil's contribution, but ExxonMobil, we have to remember, has a long debt to the Acehnese people. They are by far the largest corporation operating in Aceh, and the amount of profit that they derive from this region is enormous. It dwarfs any other industry in the area. And while we're glad that they're helping, sadly, all too long, Exxon has been part of the problem in Aceh. As our lawsuit has alleged, Exxon has knowingly operated its facilities, its natural gas facilities, on the northeastern coast of Aceh. And they've done so by hiring the Indonesian military forces to provide security, knowing all along, as is a matter of public record, that the Indonesian military's record in that area has been a very difficult one. The military has committed many human rights abuses against the people of Aceh in that area. And their collaboration with ExxonMobil has only worsened the problem.
Derek Baxter, you recently returned, in fact, just a week before the tsunami hit from Indonesia. Can you talk about what you were doing there?
Certainly. I was very close to Aceh, and part of the problem in actually going to Aceh is that the Indonesian government has not regularly allowed foreigners, journalists, NGOs, et cetera, to enter without securing special permission, which is very difficult to get. So I was in North Sumatra, very close to Aceh, and I met with numerous people, villagers, who lived very close to the ExxonMobil facilities in Aceh, who traveled at great personal risk to themselves to North Sumatra, the area where I was, to meet with me. And they told me of continuing human rights abuses. Just on the eve of the tsunami, the human rights situation in that part of Aceh was severe, and if anything, it was worsening. I spoke with people who told me that military assigned to protect the ExxonMobil facilities accosted them, extorted them, asked them regularly for contributions of money, of rice, of possessions, which these people had very little. And if there was any protests, they would often be attacked. They would be hauled away from their families, beaten. I spoke to a very young man who had been shot in the right knee, very gruesome. But these atrocities were commonplace. They didn't surprise anybody that I was talking to, because sadly, in that area, right by the ExxonMobil facilities, those abuses of that type have been going on for years, for the entire last decade. We've even heard reports, which we're trying to verify, that five people were killed actually on the liquefaction plant that ExxonMobil helps to operate. As the ILRF has noted in our lawsuit, which we filed in 2001, the torture and murder, disappearance, sexual assault of people, Acehnese, living close to these ExxonMobil facilities was all too routine over the last years.
Derek Baxter, if you're talking about the Indonesian military, why do you hold ExxonMobil accountable?
That's an excellent question, and we're not seeking to hold them accountable for everything, obviously, that happens in Aceh. There's a long, ongoing civil strife in that area. But in this particular area, ExxonMobil has contracted, as we've said and alleged in our complaint, they have contracted with the Indonesian military to provide security just for the ExxonMobil facilities. And we've alleged that this relationship with the Indonesian military includes providing money directly to them. It includes constructing buildings on ExxonMobil grounds, which the military has used for the torture and disappearance of Achenese. It includes providing excavating equipment, which ExxonMobil has provided to the military, and which we've alleged the military has then used to construct mass graves of the victims. It's a very close, ongoing relationship. And you have to remember that ExxonMobil wields enormous financial power in this region. And if they are choosing to utilize a military force that has been criticized by many human rights groups for their violations, then we believe, and we believe the law will hold us out on this point, that ExxonMobil will be legally liable for these violations.
Derek Baxter, we have to break. When we come back, we will also talk with Bama Threa about the overall region. Today, there's a piece in the Washington Post that talks about the collaboration between the U.S. military right now and the Indonesian military. Yesterday, we went up to the UN mission, to the Indonesian mission to the United Nations, where there was a gathering of Achenese refugees who were encouraging international aid organizations not to funnel their money through the Indonesian government. And they were calling on the Indonesian military not to stop the aid going into Aceh. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to discuss one of the largest corporate contributors to the relief efforts, ExxonMobil, $5 million. They say they are giving. We wish we could have them on the program. They declined to participate, but we are talking about an ongoing lawsuit that involves ExxonMobil and its running of one of the largest gas fields in the world in Aceh. I believe that its facility there was not actually damaged by the tsunami. We're joined in Washington studios by two members of the International Labor Rights Fund. We're joined by the deputy director of the International Fund, Bama Athreya, as well as Derek Baxter, who is the lawyer who's just returned from Indonesia a week before the tsunami, interviewing people who are participating in the lawsuit against the against ExxonMobil. I was wondering, Bama Athreya, if you could put this in the context of Indonesia, which you have worked on for many years, and in the context of what's happening right now, the massive, the cataclysm that has taken place and what is taking place in Aceh.
Sure. That's a big question, Amy, and I'll try and focus it a little bit on the things that you just mentioned. You had mentioned that there has been a call from a number of activists to ensure that the aid that people are so very generously giving to the victims of the tsunami is not all funneled through the Indonesian military. And on context, I think it's important for people here who are, you know, giving very generously on a personal level to recognize the political context in Aceh. The Indonesian military has been operating basically a war against a separatist movement in Aceh for decades now, and that has had a lot of fallout in terms of human rights violations against innocent civilians throughout Aceh. It's also important to remember that the Indonesian military itself are an extremely corrupt institution. It's estimated that only about 40% of the military's basic operating costs are paid for by the Indonesian government. That means they get the other 60% through extortion. You mentioned that ExxonMobil's given $5 million to the relief effort. Well, we would sure love to know how much ExxonMobil has given to the Indonesian military over the years. We know they've paid them. We know they've given them logistical support. We know they've housed them. I'm just guessing that their donations, if you'd like to call it that, to the Indonesian military over the years have been far in excess of the $5 million they're now giving to the poor victims in Aceh. So we're looking at a context where we've got a very corrupt institution, the Indonesian military, which has been extorting local Achenese villagers, which has been running drug operations and prostitution rings in Aceh, which has been involved in illegal timber operations in Aceh. And now we are going to trust this same institution to be the folks who deliver the aid to the Achenese victims. It's not a great idea, Amy, and I think that's one of the reasons why we share the position of some of our human rights colleagues here in the U.S., that there have got to be some transparent systems in place to deliver aid to make sure those people in Aceh that have suffered the most really truly get the food and the medicine that people are donating.
As you mentioned, Bama, Achenese and human rights groups have been protesting the funneling of aid to the Indonesian military. Yesterday, outside the Indonesian mission to the UN, a gathering of Achenese refugees took place. They marched from the UN to thank them for supporting huge relief efforts in Indonesia, but then marched over to the Indonesian mission to the UN, condemning what they call the Indonesian government's haphazard response to the tsunami. They accused the Indonesian armed forces of continuing their military operations in Aceh and of preventing the delivery of aid to victims of the earthquake and tsunami. The refugees charged that rather than helping the people in a number of areas, the troops are intimidating villagers, scaring away them away from their villages, looting their homes, stealing food. They called on the military to implement an immediate ceasefire. In a moment, we'll be joined by two Achenese refugees in this country. They're in our studio today. But first, a few of those who were outside the UN mission. This is Eddie Suheri, who is an Achenese journalist who got political asylum in the United States. He's a student now in New York City.
So we are here today to to let the world know that aid that they sent to Indonesia is not received by people in need. So, and according to my family and an activist that I called to contact to Manache, and they said that Indonesian military asked people to show their ID and a letter from the administrator in order to have to get the food, to get aid. So it doesn't make sense because in this situation they shouldn't ask for that. And you know how many people who still has have ID. So that very ridiculous, I think.
Eddie Suhari, an Achenese refugee now in New York City, going to LaGuardia College. We now turn to Adil Abdul, who his plea to the world community not to give aid to the Indonesian government.
I want to tell to the world, please don't give aid to the Indonesian government. It's, you know, it's, it doesn't mean nothing. The money, it's not going to our people. This is going to be corrupted by the people in the Indonesian government. Please, please. It's enough, it's enough. Our people is starving. Our people is dying now.
Who should get the aid?
People who are victims and tsunami victims, for sure, for that.
That was Adil Abdul speaking in front of the Indonesian mission to the United Nations. We turn now to Cut Zahara, who could not bear to think about almost having lost her younger brother in the disaster in Aceh.
My brother, the youngest one, was missing for 2 days. And that make me almost, you know, crazy to think about that. And thanks God he came home on Tuesday and he survived.
That is Cut Zahara speaking outside the United Nations yesterday, talking about her younger brother and the fact that although they feared that he was lost, he did survive. But Cut Zahara's other brother did not survive. He was not, though, a victim of the tsunami. Zahara's older brother is Jafar Siddiq Hamza. He was a human rights lawyer who lived in the United States and who returned to Aceh to help people in his homeland. He was disappeared on August 5th, 2000, yesterday in front of the United Nations. Zahara described the condition in which her older brother Jafar's body was found.
When we found it, the people found it, not us. It's not only one body, but another fourth body. So they found five bodies. The villagers found five bodies. And those bodies is naked, no clothes at all. And the hand and feet was wrapped.
Was tied?
Tied. So, we can see that all body has been tortured, dead because of the torture.
Was his face cut?
I'm not sure about that because the face is already like dry. You know, when we think about, I cannot imagine how his face in that time because I want to keep his face as the face I know as my brother. So, yeah. Yeah.
So what message do you have for the international community now?
We really thank you for helping us because we know you do your best to help Achenese right now. But we want you, to keep doing that, not just for for this tsunami session, but please help us to start over.
Cut Zahara asking for people to help the Indonesian people, the Achenese, to start over. She, too, at the protest, calling for aid groups not to give money to the Indonesian military, but to give it to human rights groups in the area helping the Achenese people. We're joined in the studio by two refugees from Aceh, Munawar Zainal and Tuku Hendra. Munawar Zainal is an Achenese student activist who runs the Aceh Center in Pennsylvania. Tukahendra is also an Achenese student. His mother is very well known in Aceh, Tukatnur Asikin. She was a women's rights leader in Aceh. She was imprisoned by the Indonesian government, held in the prison in Banda Aceh. And since the tsunami, her body has not been found. You know, as Chut Zahara was speaking about her brother Jafar, who wasn't a victim of the tsunami, but who died several years before, his body found wrapped in barbed wire, his face cut. I remembered that Jafar was a guest on Democracy Now! A few years ago, actually talking about ExxonMobil and talking about the what happens to the Achenese people with the Indonesian military that is protecting the ExxonMobil gas fields. Munawar Zainal, you knew Jafar.
Yeah, I met him in Banda Aceh in 2000. And before he disappeared, he also worked with me in Banda Aceh. We are working together because when he back to Aceh, he coordinates the activists there and we are working together to internationalize the issue of Aceh.
And what has happened to your family now since the tsunami?
I lost 20 of my extended families and my mother safe. And I don't know the fate.
Your mother is safe.
Yeah. But I don't know the fate of all the family that living just in the coastal area of PD.
You come from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
Yes, I'm living in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
Why there and not Aceh?
I'm a student activist in Aceh. And then we are working for the democracy in Aceh. And also for the self-determination for the people of Aceh. Because of our activities, the Indonesian military put us in the operation target. For example, many of the friends working with SIRA got arrested by the Indonesian military and also got killed by the Indonesian military.
What is SIRA?
SIRA is Aceh Referendum Information Center. And the leader of SIRA also arrested by the Indonesian military, and they put him in jail for 5 years, and he sent to Java Island.
And so how did you end up here?
And then after they targeting the human rights activists, and I am one of the subject of their terrorist action, and then they terrorized me and my family, and
how?
Then by visiting my mom and telling the family that if I am not surrender myself to the military post, they will rape my mom and they will kidnap my mom. So my mom and also other friends from the activists tell me that to escape from Indonesia as soon as possible. And also in Jakarta at that time, I coordinated the population of Achenese in Jakarta to demonstrate against Indonesian military abuses in Aceh.
Tukahendra, your mother, can you tell us about Tukatnur Asikin?
Yeah, my mom is Tukatnur Asikin. She activist working for democracy in Aceh. And she one the leader of the speaker in the front of the referendum rally in Banda Aceh.
Now, we've seen, and I think for many in the world, for the first time, yes, Banda Aceh and the picture of the large mosque there. Now it's just devastated the area outside of the mosque. But that was the area of the largest protest, I believe, Indonesia has seen. Is that right?
Yes.
Just a few years ago.
And my mom, she died by the tsunami, and nobody can find her body now.
Where was she?
In the jail.
She was in the Banda Aceh jail?
In the Banda Aceh Lokna.
What was she sentenced for? Why was she in jail?
Because she is a political activist in Banda Aceh, and she won referendum for Aceh, and she got 11 years arrested by Indonesia government, and when the tsunami coming, the jail got broke very bad, and nobody can find her body yet.
When did you come to this country? When she was in jail or before?
Before her in jail.
Why did you come here?
When 2001, my family got beat target by Indonesia government. That's why I'm escaped to from Banda Aceh to United States.
Why didn't your mother leave also?
Because we got my young brother and my sister still in Indonesia, but the other place from Aceh. My mother have to go to Indonesia and go to United States to take care of us.
Mm-hmm. But your mother stayed
in Indonesia when like a couple months, and she got arrested by Indonesia government.
And so she couldn't leave.
Yeah.
In Washington, we are still joined by Bama Threya of the International Labor Rights Fund. The protest yesterday, there was a very strong call for relief groups not to give money to the Indonesian government, to the Indonesian military, but to work with Achenese and Indonesian human rights groups. What is your sense, Bama, of what relief organizations are doing? Because so many of them work through the governments.
Organizations have had limited access to Aceh, and one of our main concerns is that the relief groups need to have much better direct access. Frankly, they don't need the Indonesian military to deliver the aid. Yes, we know that roads have been washed out, that infrastructure has been destroyed, but let's face it, groups like the Red Cross have a long, long history of going into disaster situations and being able to create and set up the sort of infrastructure that's needed to deliver food, medicine, etc. We are pushing now, and we think that relief groups as well need to be very vocal about demanding direct access to be able to deliver the relief themselves. That's the only way to ensure that it's not diverted into the wrong hands, that the military doesn't sit on stockpiles or otherwise deny relief to the people who need it most.
Well, let me ask our guests in the studio that very question, the issue of how people who are in the direst need right now should be helped. Many would argue that because the military is all throughout Aceh, they're in the best position to be able to provide aid. What do you think about that?
That's not true, because the Indonesian military, actually, they can do more. They got Hercules, Bronco, and they can drop the assistance to the people of Aceh. But until day of fifth day or of the tsunami, the assistance still not coming to western part of Aceh.
What about this issue that we are now hearing that people raised yesterday outside the Indonesian mission to the UN, that the Indonesian military is asking for ID cards before they will give food to someone? What are these ID cards?
That's right. They also not just asking the ID card. Also, they conducted the sweeping. So, for example, people from eastern part or northern part of Aceh, they want to visit their family in Banda Aceh. When they pass the military checkpoint, and they still asking the ID from the people.
Now, what if you're a survivor of a tsunami, you may not have your ID with you.
That's right, sir.
But what is the significance of the ID? Who has it and who doesn't have it?
In Aceh, the Indonesian military, since the martial law, they are imposing the special ID for the Achenese. Every Achenese must have a special ID that different with another ID in Indonesia. And anybody that doesn't have the ID, they will be accused as a Free Aceh Movement member, and they will be subject of intimidation and also torture by the military.
So they're accused of being rebels.
That's right.
And so the Indonesian military is using this now as a way to flush out, to figure out who is sympathizers with the rebels and who isn't?
Yeah, that's right. And also, it's very interesting in this condition, all the assistance must distribute it through the TNI.
That's the Indonesian military.
And it's not help the Achenese, because limited tool by the military, they don't have enough tool for that. For this we are thanking the American by sending the USS Abraham Lincoln, and then can directly involve in assisting the Achenese. And also the condition of the assistance, it's stuck in the airport outside Aceh, especially in Jakarta and Medan. And if Indonesian military and Indonesian government withdraw the, I mean, they leave the martial law in Aceh and they open Aceh unrestrictedly, it will be helping Achenese much, much more than this.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us, Munawar Zainal and Tuku Hendra, for being with us, both Achenese refugees here in the United States, part of a small community of Achenese refugees that are here. And also want to thank Derek Baxter and Bama Athreya from the International Labor Rights Fund in Washington, D.C., both involved in the lawsuit against ExxonMobil and its gas operation in Aceh. Again, we invited ExxonMobil to join us. They declined. This is Democracy Now! When we come back from our break, we'll look at the opening of the 109th Congress. In just a few minutes after this broadcast, the Congressional Black Caucus will be sworn in. We will speak with Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton. We'll also speak with Lou DuBose about what happened last night in a private meeting of the Republican Congress members and what they are doing about the scandal around Tom DeLay. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we broadcast on over 300 Pacifica NPR public access TV, PBS stations, and on both satellite networks, Dish Networks 9415, Free Speech TV 9410, Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375, also video and audio streaming at democracynow.org. And on the TV program, we are doing closed captioning so the deaf and hard of hearing can access Democracy Now! Well, we are now on the first day of the 109th Congress, and we are joined by Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton of Washington, D.C. Last night, she put out a statement about the passing of Shirley Chisholm, the first African-American woman elected to Congress and a 1972 presidential candidate who died this weekend at the age of 80 in Florida. Shirley Chisholm was an outspoken advocate for women, for people of color, fierce opponent of the Vietnam War, raised in New York City, went to Congress to represent New York the same year Richard Nixon was elected to the White House. She served 2 years into Ronald Reagan's tenure, was also a founding member of the Congressional Black Caucus in 1969. And just a few minutes after this broadcast, Eleanor Holmes Norton will join with others in being sworn in as Congressional Black Caucus members. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Eleanor Holmes Norton.
Thank you, Amy. Good to be with you.
It's good to have you with us. Thank you for spending this few minutes before you head off to Congress. Can you talk about Shirley Chisholm and what she would think about this Congress and the agenda that you are facing?
Well, the woman who knew how to fight on all sides, you could never, surround Shirley with too many enemies. And because she would be among the most senior members, she would now be ranking member of an important committee. She would have served her term as chair of the African, of the Black Caucus, and she would be out front leading us in what is going to be a formidable battle. To understand Shirley, one has to understand that she's not just the first, this, that, or the other. She was up against the whole world when she ran for Congress. She was up against the Brooklyn Machine, probably the most formidable in the country at the time. She was up against men, because the whole notion of this woman getting this rare seat to come up in New York was unheard of. Who did she think she was? I was there. I lived in New York. I'm a native Washingtonian, but my children were born in New York. We lived in New York at the time, and I heard what they had to say. And finally, Amy, she was up against history. We were only then beginning to get used to having a critical mass, and that's all they were, of African-American men in Congress. She, for example, was part of the group that formed the Black Caucus. Now, here comes a woman, when there aren't even many men, and says, look, I want to join you guys. Nobody was ready for it but the black women in Brooklyn, who I think are chiefly responsible for putting her over, and then everybody joined the crowd.
Today, you'll be sworn in as a member of the Congressional Black Caucus. As the Congress is sworn in, Republican lawmakers met last night. Some political analysts say in a meeting that was intended to strip Democrats of ammunition against the Republicans and the ethics scandal dogging Majority Leader Tom DeLay. House Republicans suddenly reversed course Monday, deciding to retain a tough standard for lawmaker discipline and reinstate a rule that would force Majority Leader Tom DeLay to step aside if he's indicted by a Texas grand jury. Already, three of DeLay's associates have been indicted by a Texas grand jury in connection with illegal fundraising. The prosecutor has said the investigation isn't finished. The surprise dual decisions were made by Speaker Dennis Hastert and by DeLay, who asked the Republican colleagues to undo the extreme act of loyalty they handed him in November. Then Republicans changed a party rule so DeLay could retain leadership even if he is indicted. Republicans gave no indication before the meeting that the indictment rule was going to change. A spokesperson for House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi said Republicans pulled back on the discipline rule because, quote, the issue simply became too hot for them to handle. What does this mean, Eleanor Holmes Norton, for you in Congress?
Well, I don't think that we who are Democrats can take full credit for this, but I think they knew we were noted for bear. There has to be a debate on the floor on the rules package, and there already were a full line of speakers lined up to talk only about this extraordinary move to say that if you are indicted and you are the leader of your party, you can continue to be the leader of your party in the House of Representatives. That was so over the top. And thanks to people like you and journalists all over the country, I think the Republicans came to understand that every time any issue came up, Tom DeLay would be the issue. They also remembered, Newt Gingrich, who went down on an ethics violation and ultimately left the House and, of course, left the speakership. So I really think that this is a lesson to Democrats. Get loaded for a fight on every issue the way we got loaded for the fight, the ethics fight, particularly get loaded for the Social Security fight.
Eleanor Holmes Norton, I want to thank you for joining us. I know you're heading off to be sworn in. We are also joined by Lou DeBose, author of a new political biography on Tom DeLay called The Hammer, Tom DeLay, God, Money, and the United States Congress. Your thoughts today on what this means for Tom DeLay, this sudden last-minute move last night right before the opening of the 109th Congress?
Well, Amy, remember 2 months ago he asked for this rule to be changed, and now he rescinded. He backed down. He backed away from the brink. I think it just, you know, there's only so much adverse publicity one leader can stand. But you know, do bear in mind that the caucus conference yesterday voted to substantially weaken ethics committee procedural rules, you know, and now will require the Republicans, the majority, to vote. It used to be 4-4. After 45 days, any complaint would be acted upon automatically. Now it will require a Republican vote. So, you know, it lost in this about the Republicans backing down on the most egregious rule is one that will protect delay in the future and others in the future, and there are other Republicans in Congress. So the ethics procedure is still under assault. They're still talking about pulling Joel Heffley, the committee chair, and replacing him with a delay lackey, Lamar Smith from here in San Antonio, who contributed to Tom DeLay's defense fund, who benefited from Tom DeLay's redistricting of the redrawing of the state lines and state district lines in Texas, which is precisely what DeLay has gotten in trouble for. That's why his three guys are indicted here in Texas.
Well, let's talk about this grand jury and this prosecutor. I was just in Austin for the 50th anniversary of the Texas Observer, and congratulations, Lou, for that.
Oh, thank you. It was great you were here.
But there was a lot of discussion about the prosecutor. Explain who he is and what is the possibility Tom DeLay will be indicted.
Well, first, the complaint that this is a political witch hunt is preposterous. You know, Ronnie Earle has prosecuted 12 Democrats and 3 Republicans, and he is a Democratic district attorney with statewide prosecutorial authority because he's in the Capitol and he has a special division that's charged with investigating political crimes. He has what lawyers like in a case, which is the law and the facts on his side. It's against the law in Texas to raise corporate money. They've admitted that they raised corporate money. They raised corporate money and used it in an election, so we don't even have to say allegedly. You know, Ronnie Earle is this is his last big case. He's been here for 26 years. He avoided retiring. He changed his mind in retiring to pursue this case because he said you can't steal an election in Texas and brag about it. And Tom DeLay has met a little man in terms of politics who has real political stature and character, and they're worried that he won't back down, and he may well be indicted. And if not, we're going to have a long trial with a lot of discovery that's going to be pointing its fingers at a lot of DeLay people. There's another DeLay scandal. You know, $81 million was stolen by two lobbyists. $81 million in lobbying fees were charged to 6 American Indian tribes by Jack Abramoff and Mike Scanlon, two close DeLay associates. That investigation is going on in the Senate. There's a grand jury investigation in Washington, and a couple of people are probably going to be indicted. They're also looking at Congressman Bob Ney's role in this, and he would have been protected by the never-been-indicted rule if he's indicted, because Bob Ney took a lot of money, took a $100,000 golf trip, which they requested Abramoff and Scanlon, two DeLay associates who are lobbyists, who charged these Indians $81 million essentially for nothing. So here is the leader of the House, the majority leader, is surrounded by scandal. And it's everywhere. So the ethics committee was neutered, and it will be neutered today because it's going to now require the Republicans to vote all the Republicans of the committee to vote to proceed with an investigation.
Can you comment on this other Republican proposal that would allow relatives to accompany a House member on a trip financed by a special interest group? Current rules specify only a spouse or a child can go along.
Right. Well, you know, it's just more pigs at the trough. You know, this was a rule that when the Republicans were the good guys, they you couldn't take lobby perks anymore. When Newt Gingrich came in promising to clean out the Democratic corruption in the House, DeLay changed that rule 3 years ago to allow golf trips, and it just broadens the number of people who can get lobby perks, and essentially lobby payoffs. And you know, this golf trip to Scotland cost $100,000, and Bob Ney went, and Congressman Bob Ney went after Jack Abramoff called the Indian tribes and said, "Give us $50,000 apiece to take a congressman who needs your help to a golf trip to Scotland. He also said, we've done this one time before for you-know-who. You-know-who was Tom DeLay.
Lou DuBose, on that note, I want to thank you for being with us, biographer of Tom DeLay. His biography is called The Hammer. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jeremy Scahill, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Anna Noguera, Sharif Abdelkaddous, and Mike Burke. Our engineers are Ryan Abernathy and Mike DeFilippo. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.